يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series taking a close look at the Middle East, North Africa region. Well, hello everybody, and a very warm welcome to Middle East Analysis, the first of 2026, and possibly, just possibly the last, but we'll come on to that in a minute. You'll hear my tone start to drop if that is the case. But certainly there's a likelihood that we will be going on something of a hiatus. As such, wipe the tears away. But what we're actually going to do is take a bit of a look back over 17 years of Middle East Analysis, started in 2009, going to this present day in 2026. That's a very long time. And as you know, listeners, in that region, that's an awful lot of ground that has been covered by our studio guest, our regular studio guest, Dr. Harry Hagopian. Harry, how are you doing?
I'm fine, James. I'm a little bit dumbstruck because when you say 17 years and we might be just at the end of an experience, an adventure that has taken us to so many different countries, so many different conflicts, so many different permutations over those 17 years, it's almost that you are parting with a good friend.
Yeah.
And that is part of me is feeling that. But then another part of me says, and I was discussing this with one of your assistants, that if you do not have a sense of renewal in life, if you do not change, if you do not do something a little bit different and you stick in your comfort zone, then after a while it gets either boring or decaying. And so let us hope. I don't know. I'm like you. Part of me says this is the end of the road for Middle East Analysis. It has to reinvent itself, you and our guest, you will introduce him, or that we might actually find another way of doing this, which is slightly different from what we have been doing to date. Why? Because the world has changed. We have been talking for 17 years about Middle East Analysis when we have implicitly thought that there is a rules-based international order that is still prevalent, that is still valid, no matter the violations, no matter how many times United Nations Security Council resolutions are not respected or adhered to. But there was a certain understanding that the world is the one you and I grew up in. However, over the last 2-3 years, all that has gone astray. So in my books, the compass has moved and has moved dramatically. So to keep doing the same thing when the whole world is looking at things differently, I think is not really worth your time, certainly because you're busy. It's certainly not worth our guest's time. And again, you'll introduce our guest. And it's not worth my time. So maybe this hiatus, this breathing space, will be like one of the BBC cliffhangers. We stop somewhere here and then we let it percolate a bit and maybe come all the more stronger.
Well, it all depends, doesn't it, how long things are going to percolate for, I suppose. But one point you made is that we're not on our own in this studio today. We have been on many occasions. In fact, it's actually quite rare we have a guest.
It's very rare that we have a guest.
And it's, well, I say that, we have the same guest that we've had for the last couple of occasions, which is great.
Mm.
Bishop Jim Curry.
Well, I'm glad I've been invited back. I take that as a compliment.
Absolutely right. And sterling contribution it was to the last time. Now, how do you feel about the prospect of this being the end? Or maybe not not
well,
au revoir.
au revoir, perhaps. Not or adieu. I don't know. My French is not
adieu.
Adieu, yeah. Or hors d'oeuvre, as one famous
Come
person
on, Harry. That's your speciality.
It's not farewell. It's maybe see you again.
Yeah, and I'm late to the party, so to speak, as a participant. But I've been listening, not for 17 years, but I've been listening to a few years to MENA analysis. And I think, like all of your regular listeners, we've gained so much from your insights and your reflections and sometimes your predictions and your warnings. So I think we'll miss that insight in this format.
Yeah.
But as you say, you know, there may be other expressions. I'm looking forward to listening to you two, looking back over those 17 years, seeing what's changed, what's developed, and then perhaps just having a moment at the end to reflect on what we've learnt.
Yeah.
And what could the future look like?
Yeah, and I think actually, to be honest, it has a certain poignant symmetry to it in many ways, because we are at the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales in the radio studio, the place that I think we probably recorded the overwhelming majority. We have gone out on the street, so to speak.
We have gone out on the street,
occasions.
But remember, during COVID, we did it remotely as well.
Yes,
and you had to teach me how to work the apps.
Yeah, well, you did a good job. In fact, you're doing quite a lot of it now. So,
I wondered where you learned those skills.
Well, I mean, you've overtaken me, which is appropriate. That is absolutely fine. But Bishop Jim, we're not going to sort of put you on ice, as it were, for now, because we are going to talk about the Christians of the Middle East, North Africa, mm-hmm. the region, as we have on many occasions. And I think that's perhaps where it comes full circle, and we can look at the realities now versus what they were in 2009 when we started this, Harry. But actually, I'm feeling a bit of the sadness, because even if it does reinvent, and I'll be honest with you, I hope it does, but at the same time, what will that look like? Who will it involve? What shape will it take?
You know, we are not we're only a two-person, sometimes a three-person operation. It's not that difficult, but a lot of much bigger operations, podcasts done by... So if you've noticed the proliferation of podcasts recently, everybody is now doing a podcast because everybody feels that the world is in a different place, and the world is in a dangerous place. And I have said this in the past, and I'll say it again without sounding dramatic at all, that I worry about what is in store for us in Europe. Not only in the Middle East, North Africa and the Gulf, not only whether America would attack Iran or not, not only what is going to happen in Gaza and in the West Bank of Palestine, but what is going to happen in Europe, because Europe is disjointed, dyslexic, politically unable to get its act together. It's more of an economic center rather than a political center. And in this political configuration that we are facing today, with Russia on the one side and the United States on the other side, both of them totally disrespectful of international law, with China on the ascendancy, economics plus politics, I am worried that we might get a conflict, a war. Some people I know, associates and friends of mine, have commented to me, and only recently, that we mightn't be surprised if we get a small world war. Now, they call it world war because it's good for drama, but we might get a regional war in Europe as a consequence of what's happening between Russia and Ukraine, what's happening in America, where it has gone completely rogue, what's happening with China, and what is happening in our own country, where we are basically unsure of what to do or not to do, because the leadership that we require, largely political but also religious, is not entirely there.
No, absolutely. And where it might be seen as not related, but I think it is. When you were speaking, I was thinking also about presidents, politicians and others involved in sharing sort of deep fake material, or, you know, really quite disparaging stuff. It's as if sort of good statesmanship, and you talk about the rules-based order, obviously what one has to take that point, but it's also got a bit of a nasty undercurrent, hasn't it, in terms of mockery, in terms of disrespect. It's almost like everything has been ripped up, which makes...
all that, James, is when you break the rules-based international order, and as I've written in a couple of op-eds recently, the world order has been replaced by world disorder. And the sooner we get to grips with that, and the sooner we realize that we've got to change a little bit the direction of our own compasses in order to be able to if not confront or face, but at least manage to survive in a world where you see what the US administration is doing, you see what Russia is doing, you see what China's motivations are, you see where the world is going, and you think, blimey, I'm glad that I grew up and lived and we did 17 years of our MEA podcast in a world where, even though in the MENA region it was so disorderly because of the Arab Spring, because of the fights, because of the wars, because of the genocides, because of the conflicts, but at least there was something like a United Nations, like an International Court of Justice, like recently, more recently, the International Criminal Court, which were still valid. Now, the new reality is that people, politicians, are trying to damage these institutions that are a legacy of World War II. So if we're not going to be able to defend those, and we're going to go into a situation where the United Nations is replaced by something called a Board of Peace, I mean, how much more nonsensical can the world get, and how much, therefore, more frightening it can get? Which is why to talk about the MENA region, to talk about, oh, what's happened in Palestine, in Syria, in Libya, in Yemen, in Iraq, in Jordan, in Israel, and then sort of sometimes come up with predictions, some of which we got right during those 17 years, and some of which, including Syria, for instance, we didn't get right because we thought Bashar al-Assad would leave or would be removed far, far sooner than he actually was removed.
Well, do you remember, it used to be year on year. We used to say months, then it was years.
Absolutely. And that is where you used to joke, if you remember, by always telling me, Harry reminds us that he's not a prophet, but...
And we've had a lot of fun with that.
We had a lot of fun with he's not a prophet, but... Mm. So now I feel that we need to move forward. And during those 17 years, if I may allow myself to mention Bishop Declan Lange, who was the head of international affairs.
And appeared on a fair few of these. Actually.
At the conference here, yeah, where you are recording this podcast in the studio, Bishop Declan was not only supportive of our podcast, but like you said, he came and sat in exactly the same chair where Bishop Jim is now sitting. And I'm using your name since he already introduced you, Bishop.
And
he and I used to laugh, and he and I used to think, he and I went to Lebanon together, so we used to compare notes about Lebanon. We used to talk about Palestine. He had the fortune, the good fortune, between inverted commas, of going to Gaza two or three times as well before Gaza was razed to the ground. And he used to talk about how much it moved him, how much it hurt him, how much it dispirited him to see what was happening. And Bishop Declan is no longer in the framework of Middle East analysis. Now we have a new lead bishop for the Middle East, Bishop Jim Curry. So maybe the next step, the future step, if the Conference of Bishops can get their act together, and if you and I can sit together...
Thanks for making my job a bit easier by saying that.
And mine.
And formulate something, maybe after a hiatus, if you want to call it a hiatus, I call it a breathing space, we can maybe address the situation differently. As you know, I had the pleasure of meeting your new General Secretary at the conference today. Yeah. And I mentioned to him about our 17-year trek. And I sort of said, now Bishop Jim is supporting our podcast the way Bishop Declan was in the past. And hopefully we will still be able sometimes to limp along, sometimes to sprint along. But it depends on what happens in the world. And am I worried about the world? I am worried about the world. Let me say something else you and I used to joke about. I'm Armenian. And
never would have guessed.
And therefore, I always introduce into our conversations the Armenian aspect. Now, yeah, the Armenians have many conflicts these days. the Holy See in Echmiadzin in Armenia is at loggerheads with the government. The Armenian quarter of Jerusalem is in a problematic point of view. So this is a microcosm of a far, far larger situation that is actually splashing across the whole region, and it is certainly affecting Europe. Greenland is a very interesting example of that. If United States and Trump, when he woke up one day at 5 in the morning and started sending out his messages, he said, tomorrow we're going to go and attack Greenland. I would like to see what Europe would have done at that stage. And all those people who use big words, France, UK, etc., to help Denmark in the situation. So a pause is a good thing, because sometimes it's good to go to mass when there is a lot of noise. Sometimes it's good to have a quiet contemplation.
I think Bishop Jim might agree with that. Would that be fair to say? Sometimes that pause is worthwhile.
Yes, I mean, it's always wise to stop and reflect, isn't it? And ask yourself, what have we learnt? Where are the few directions? I completely concur with Harry's analysis of the way the world is. The world we grew up in and accepted. Mm. That world order, the talk of human rights. I mean, it's almost laughable in some situations to talk about civil and human rights because nobody's paying any attention. Let me just say also about Bishop Declan Lang, and I'm very happy to sit in his seat, so to speak, in this studio. And as you know, he's retired now as a bishop, and we wish him well.
We do.
And we've all benefited from his wisdom, and the Bishop's Conference certainly has over many, many years. Yeah, so it was lovely to be able to remember him.
And you know what, Bishop Declan, whom I'm sure you know well enough, but what I used to really love about him, because we became friends and I've been to his house on a number of occasions, his sense of humor.
Yeah.
And he had a sense of humor. You have a sense of humor. It's a slightly different sense of humor, but that's fine. It's still sense of humor. So it's not such a radical departure from what we had in that chair before you.
I'll tell you this as well. Lamenting the breakdown of rules, regulations, sane barriers and so forth. I tell you, if you don't have a sense of humor, you'd probably be in tears, wouldn't you? I mean, it is vital at this point.
You would either be in tears, or you would be so well wrapped up in your sense of arrogance and impunity that you wouldn't even recognize what's happening, and you stop thinking of the larger good, and you start thinking only of the self. Mm. And that is where politics becomes tribal. And I am all against tribal. In the church, I've always advocated ecumenism. I know where my faith lies, but I speak to Lutherans, Anglicans, Copts, anybody else, because we all share something. We might differ on the details, but we share some core beliefs. The same happens with politics. If you start throwing away the United Nations, disregarding the statements of the ICJ in The Hague, you start, as the bishop said very rightly so, human rights is no longer on the agenda. I mean, I sometimes really don't know whether I should be more aghast by what President Trump says or what President Putin says.
Now, that's interesting. Now, I'm going to sort of segue, Bishop Jim, into, not whimsically, I do hope, but looking back over those 17 years. And as you say, I mean, recent to the party, it doesn't really matter. I know you've heard, and I think hopefully I'm not overstretching here, but just as a personal point, I've learned so much from Dr. Harry Hagopian here, both as a professional and as a friend, actually. Yeah. He's been giving me very wise counsel on all manner of matters, you know, in front of, behind the mic, all sorts, really. So I'm very grateful. I feel like I've learnt certainly an awful lot about the Christians of the Middle East, North Africa.
The ones in the Middle East, North Africa, the ones I am interested in are the indigenous, local, largely but not entirely Arab Christians. Those are the ones that matter to me. Those are the ones that sometimes struggle and sometimes are very firm in their witness of their faith. These are the people we should talk about. So when people start telling me, this person came from America, that person came from Scandinavia, living in Jerusalem, that is different, because religion is not only what you know about theology or how you what you were taught when you had your Holy Communion, etc. Religion is also cultural. And in the Middle East, particularly in the Middle East, because the Middle East, in my opinion, is more advanced these days than Europe in terms of its fidelity to its faith, is also cultural.
No, exactly. And sort of to pick up on that point, I've benefited when I've been in countries, some countries I didn't expect to be in. When I went to Rabat in Morocco, Iran, you know, I've been to Tehran for not too long, over a week though, so you do get a slight immersion.
Don't say that too loud. They might come and kidnap you.
Well, it's before I started working here, I'll tell you that.
Okay.
but that's the point in a way. You know, going to those countries, I didn't know so much. I should know about the Christian picture, but I didn't particularly. What would you say, Bishop Jim, you've learnt from Harry's insights into the picture in the Middle East, North Africa?
Oh, there's so much. I think Harry's point is well made that we what we call the West, or have always called the West, mm-hmm. have often underappreciated the fact that Christianity is rooted in the MENA region. Mm-hmm. Not just, you know, the Christianity, Islam, the great spiritual traditions in Egypt. You know, the point is well made that the Arab Christians have been part of the mosaic of those lands for over 2,000 years. You know, they're not visitors, they're not newcomers. And their faith, I've been very struck on visits and conversations with Harry, their faith is very much part of who they are. It's not an add-on. We've got very used to, in our part of the world, of privatizing faith.
Yeah.
You know, this is something we keep private and personal. In my experience of the Middle East, is that religion has a public dimension. It's part of who you are. You're proud of your religion. You support your institutions. I often think of St. Charles de Foucault when he was living in the desert. In Algeria and Morocco and traveling in those countries, he was overwhelmed by the experience of seeing Muslims at prayer. And he wished that the brother and sister Christians in his native France would pray and observe their religion so publicly. And it was that brought him back to a sense of his own faith. Sometimes we're a little frightened of that in the West, explicit examples of religion, because religion sometimes has been weaponized, as we know, by various mm-hmm. regimes, and it's always open to being misused. But at its best, it builds up people, it creates communities, and it strengthens people's resolve to live good lives.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, you've really touched on an important point there, before we go back over our historical take on our podcast, but it's sometimes those overt displays that rather than being competitive, as one sometimes likes to cast it, can sort of just, I don't know, germinate those seeds within yourself where you ask yourself, how am I referring to my own faith? How does that help me grow? Should I be a bit more confident and forthright in my faith in a healthy way? And we can be inspired by others. They don't need to be of our religion, do they?
No, well, I mean, all three of us have been in the holy city of Jerusalem, and we've walked down the Via Dolorosa, listening to Christians praying the Our Father and marking the stations of the cross, seeing Jews walking along toward the Western Wall so that they can pray there, and hearing the call to prayer from the mosques. And that heady mix,
yeah.
every person about their business in the best of days, not imposing on each other, but respecting each other and knowing that they were bound together by a sense of the other, of God. Now, we know ourselves that there are tensions in Jerusalem and in the occupied territories, the West Bank and Palestine and Israel. That's part of your discussion. But when at its best, the MENA region, people have, and Harry knows this better than I do, his own family have had this experience of living alongside each other, respecting each other, being good neighbours to each other, and actually benefiting from each other's kindness and understanding.
No, and Harry, it takes me back to when you used to speak about your dad as a GP and
yeah.
the meals shared and how sometimes you'd all jump in the car and drive to various places that now are quite inaccessible. You can't just jump into the car very easily and drive there.
It is inaccessible. It has become inaccessible because politics now dominates religious credence and religious beliefs. And people are so afraid. And some people have so falsely radicalized their faith. I mean, I can see that in Islam. I can see that in Judaism. I can see that in Christianity.
Right.
I mean, look at some of what is said in the name of Christianity, just as what is said in the name of Islam and Judaism. And you wonder, where do they come from? Granted, we keep talking about the three monotheistic traditions. And we talk about three monotheistic traditions because all three traditions believe in the one God. But their understanding of the one God is so different one from the other, that at moments of peace, at moments of quiet, that is fine. But the minute political tensions rise, then religious sentiments get inflamed as well. And that is where it becomes very, very dangerous how you express your faith and what you do. And that is why I use the word cultural as well as religious, because if you have lived long enough in the Middle East, North Africa, and you know your neighbor who happens to be a Christian or a Muslim, then in bad times, the friendship that you have actually forged will help you surmount the tensions and the difficulties that are part of that society's preoccupations. And the bishop said about Christians, Muslims, and Jews in Jerusalem and across the occupied territories. And then you modulated that by saying, and we know there are some tensions. Well, I'll tell you what. Go and stand in front of the Armenian monastery, Armenian convent, Armenian patriarchate, call it whatever you want, the Armenian church in the old city of Jerusalem. Stand there and look at the Orthodox Jews, particularly the young ones, who are walking across from the New Gate across the Armenian Patriarchate in order to get to the wall, to the temple. Every time they pass the Armenian church, every time they see a priest or somebody with a collar, they spit at them because they refuse to acknowledge them as human beings who are worthy of having their own faith. This is what happens when you have a radicalization. And that radicalization could be religious, and we see it in many places. Daesh and ISIS were a form of radicalization. The Crusades were a form of radicalization. What happens today is a form of radicalization. But then you can also see that religious radicalization being fired up, being aggravated by political radicalization. And when you have people who hold the Bible upside down in Washington, D.C., and yet talk as if they are representative of the Christians and one camp of Christianity alone, then you can well imagine the ripple effects and the consequences of that upon all the millions of people who are following, those who denounce it, those who embrace it, and those who go fighting for it.
No, absolutely right. Now, I want to just do that quick run over some of the things we've discussed.
Well, I hope so, because until now we haven't touched upon our legacy.
No, but let's be honest. Off mic, you, I think, quite rightly said, look, we don't want to make this a boring chronological...
No.
You know, just meandering through the years. But some quite extraordinary things have happened, whether it's the slightly broken prophecy of Bashar al-Assad departing quickly.
You like that. You keep coming back to that.
Well, you know, I don't get one up on you very often, Harry, so might as well cash in, as they say.
I'm making some cluttering noises, James. Sorry,
yeah,
but I'm checking
to?
Something.
No, well, I mean, I tell you what, we'll mute that mic for a second, Bishop Jim. Maybe we'll take this on.
Yeah, well, I'm just wondering, when you think back, the two of you, you know, you rest in Syria, there's Lebanon, Egypt, Iran to some extent, it casts its shadow over the region. Of all the countries that you've reflected on, I suppose a bit of a cliched question, really, which one has prospered in a way that you didn't expect and made a contribution that perhaps you didn't expect? And which one has suffered the most? And which one are you most worried about, its future prospects?
Good question.
It's a very good question. It's a long question. The first part is easier for me to answer than the second part, because most of the MENA region is a little bit in a mess at the moment. But I've always said that if you want to find an oasis in the Levant, in the Middle East, where Christians and Muslims live happily together, the first place I would point to is the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. Because in Jordan, it is an oasis. Because I'm always worried that, as the definition of oasis indicates, you think there's a water hole there. Mm. When you go there, you see there's only sand. But Jordan has managed not only to keep the peace, despite all the ructions across the whole region, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, Yemen, you name it, but it has also managed to keep interfaith relations between Christians and Muslims very peaceful.
Yeah.
So if you want me to push, I will push that. Now, I will give you another example, but it's an example that might sound very odd to some of our listeners. And it might actually, you might wonder, what is he on about? Another place where, if you talk about politics, that's another matter. But if you talk about Christian-Muslim relations, since we're talking about Arabs,
yes,
is Palestine.
Ah.
Because in Palestine, Christians and Muslims, across the decades, pre-1967, post the Six-Day War of 1967, to date, have managed to have a very normal, quite peaceful, of course there have been issues, there are issues all the time, relations between the Christians Palestinians and the Muslim Palestinians. And when people, for different reasons of their own, sort of start going on social media and saying, oh, the Christians of Palestine are leaving because they're being persecuted by the Muslims, etc., etc., that, to me, is a highly overinflated and exaggerated accusation. Most of the Palestinian Christians who are leaving are not leaving because the Muslims are going and killing them or persecuting them. They're leaving for economic reasons. Mm-hmm. And it so happens that a Christian has more contacts in the West than a Muslim has. Certainly was the case in the 60s, 70s, 80s, until the early 90s, where Christians always had a relative in Europe, had a relative here or there. And if they didn't have a relative, they would go to a church and say, well, we're of the same faith, you and I, help me to get out of this hellhole. It's a hellhole because they can't put bread and cheese over the table to feed their children. That's the main thing. But when it comes to interfaith relations, Christians and Muslims in Palestine haven't had the same kind of issues that they have perhaps had in other parts of the Levant. And why? I do not say that because I think that their halos shine more brightly or that they are more sophisticated than their fellow brothers and sisters across the region. It's because Palestinian Arabs, Christian or Muslim, have a more pressing, challenging preoccupation. And that is the occupation of their land by Israel, the illegal occupation of their land by Israel. So that objective preempts them getting into any kind of squabbles between themselves, because they have to have a united front if they're going to be able to resist in any shape or form the Israeli occupation and the and what is happening today in the West Bank with the settlers and the illegal settlers. You were there recently. You were on a clip, on a YouTube clip, I think James recorded it, where you were talking about those illegal settlements.
Yes.
Now, it doesn't matter whether it's a Christian or a Muslim. The Israeli illegal settler will not come and ask you, where were you born, a Christian or a Muslim? They will say, I want your land. I want your sheep. I want your house. And that is the preoccupation they have. Going further along the line, You go to places like Syria and Iraq. That is where things are worse. Why? Because after the first and second invasions by the United States into Iraq, where the wholesale institutions were decimated, what happened was that there is a vacuum, and in that vacuum rose all these fears and fear-mongering that could take place. And yes, when I was at the Middle East Council of Churches, Iraq was one of my briefs. And at that time, although people unimaginably inflate figures, I would say there were roughly 1 million Christians in the country, largely Chaldean Catholic or Assyrian. Now, there are 250,000. Mm. Some people would tell you, not even. They went. They went because of some of the persecution and also because of some of the political fears, but also the economic fears. So this is why when people look at the region, at the Middle East, North Africa region, the Gulf is a special case different from the Levant. If you look at the Levant and you talk to people like Professor Rashid Khalidi or others, you would see that you cannot say the Christians of one country are the same as the Christians of another country because they have different preoccupations and they have different cultural prerogatives. And that's how I would see it. But if there is a country where Christians feel as comfortable as Muslims, I would unequivocally say Jordan.
Yes.
That's really interesting, actually. The only small thing I was going to bring up, I get the bit about the harmony and the cultural bonding, if you like, in many ways between Arab Christians and Muslims in Palestine. But what about the fact that the Christians can more readily leave? Does that not affect that relationship, the fact they can go to Canada or they can go to Europe, whereas, you know, to be honest, on the other side of the coin, they're quite locked in?
Not really, because in a sense, I suppose, yes, if you want to sort of pull the string a little bit more, you might say, yes, that is a possibility. And it probably is in many cases. Somebody who knows a family or a tribe, a Bedouin tribe or something, would tell you, because there are Christian Bedouin tribes, by the way, they're not all Muslim. That is a possibility. But the reason why I don't think they get that upset is because if you accept the premise that largely, not exclusively, not entirely, but largely, Palestinian Christians leave because of economic conditions first and foremost, but they have links with the West, the Muslim Palestinians would like to do the same. And now, since the 90s onward, Muslims have moved on. And they have links as well. And they are also emigrating. They are going abroad as well. They're coming to the UK, which is causing so much unnecessary hassle in the political circles of our country here. You go to France, where I grew up. You look at those North African. You talked about Algeria and Morocco and Foucault. By the way, he was in Taipei as well.
Yes.
Don't we know it?
Really? Okay. If you look at those people in France, most of them are immigrants who came from Morocco, from Algeria, first of all because of the French colonization of Algeria, but also because of the economic condition. So today, the Muslim would also be quite happy to go if he can, unless, and this is an unless that I underline, because people like Reverend Isaac Munther, the Lutheran pastor, like Reverend Dr. Mitri Rahib, another pastor, and others, Fadi, Abuna Fadi, whom you must have met also, all these people would tell you that there are a lot of Palestinian Christians, and certainly more Palestinian Muslims, because demographically they are the majority. I mean, look at Gaza. We keep making a whole song and dance about the Palestinian about the Christians of Gaza. There are only about less than 1,000 there compared to 2 million population. Mm. But what is happening is that these people now are refusing to leave their country because of something called sumud, resistance. staying in your country so that you manage to defend as much as you can of what you still own or have as property, as land, as whatever. And why? Because despite all the promises given by Jared Kushner and all the others and this magnanimous Board of Peace that you just come and join us in the Board of Peace and then we're going to build up Gaza and you can come back and live. That's rubbish. Even if they stay in Gaza, they're only going to stay in a tiny sliver of land in southern Gaza near Rafah, which where they will have some houses. And the rest of it is what's going to happen? It's going to become Israeli settlements all the way with a Trump Tower in the middle. So the situation is that these people remember that their parents or grandparents lost everything in 1948 when they left during the Nakba, which is the big catastrophe, when Israel was declared a state and the Palestinians were defeated. They don't want to allow this to happen. And today, in the world disorder, and I link it with the beginning of our conversation here, in the world disorder that we have, which we didn't cover in our Middle East analysis, because when we sort of dithered a bit and started making it a little bit less regular, that's when the world started changing. Until True. Then, the world was in a rough place, but we understood what were the constant pillars of that world. Now, we don't have those pillars.
No.
Tomorrow, China would take Taiwan. It won't. The other day, Trump would take Greenland. I hope it won't. So you never know what's going to happen today and who's going to stop them.
Well, that's a very good question.
And this is where I think it's important to say yes to the Christian communities, but also yes to the people living there. And this sense of religious nationalism that I don't like. I was never into religion as anything other than my private faith. But when I went and worked with the Middle East Council of Churches and I was introduced to this whole cornucopia of traditions, that is when I realized that less separates us than we think. And if you and I were talking offline, off mic, earlier on, when I sent one of my emails recently about an event that we're hosting with Bishop Jim as the moderator at Our Lady of Victories on the 19th of February, when I sent my reminder, I quoted Pope Leo, who basically said at the end and concluding the week of prayer for Christian unity, he said, "We are one, let us act as one, let us be visible as one." Okay, as one doesn't mean you believe exactly like I do. But just because you and I differ on a whole range of issues doesn't mean that we don't talk to each other. No. The same applies to all this Holy Land coordination that you guys do at the conference. It applies to the more realistic. In Arabic, there is a very nice expression. Witness is not a theory. It's a way of living. And that's what needs to sort of percolate. You ask me how long does it take to percolate? That depends on the kind of coffee you're having. So that's where I would leave our listeners to think about it and say, you know, the stranger is not that different, to be honest with you. And take the example of the Samaritan, and I stop there.
Well, I mean, that's particularly profound. I was going to sort of start to gently wrap up by saying sometimes I feel that we've been like those two old guys at the start of the Muppet Show. You know, little bit grumpy, little bit of humour, a bit of jocular fun as well along the way. And it's been all those things, actually.
I like that. Yes, you've never said this before, but I actually can imagine the Muppets in front of me now and Mr. Grumpy and what have you.
Well, I only think that because when we started this, I didn't have a white beard, to be honest.
Mm.
So that's a change. I didn't even have my full complement of children. I was a father of four, now five. And in fact, the fifth is 15. So that says all you need to know about longevity.
You're a good Catholic, James.
Well, I converted. There you go, converted to the cause. But listen, I would say that we could have spent hours really talking about the things that we covered. whether it was what was termed the Arab Spring in the early days. You know, we actually started in North Africa, didn't we? We were talking about Tunisia and Algeria.
We started with Tunisia because the Arab Spring, as it was called then, a little bit wrongly, Rami Khoury, whom we've mentioned in previous podcasts as well, he never calls it the Arab Spring. He calls it the Arab Revolutionary Movements.
Yeah, and I'd just like to say one of the things I've enjoyed about the conversations that I've been listening to is being introduced to this great diversity of cultures in the Levant, in the Arab world. But also you've also brought in the academic traditions that we have been, you know, blind to. You've mentioned, you know, intellectuals and thinkers who started to challenge the way we think about the region, but also helped us to understand the region. So I think I'm going to miss that your distinctive voice and insights in this whole area, but also missing being introduced to that wider world and having a wider vision. So I do hope the both of you find a way of allowing that voice that lifts us up from our parochial concerns and reminds us that we are part one of another, and not to be afraid of that encounter with the other. As you say, the Samaritan, the other person. If we don't see each other as brothers and sisters and we're not able to speak to each other, then that world order that we cherished may never be restored.
Do you know, that's incredibly well put, Bishop Jim, to be honest. And what I would say is that from our conversations over the years, I felt better equipped going into the Holy Land, the Middle East, North Africa, as I say, which I'm far less familiar with. So I thank you for that. It's opened my eyes. I think I couldn't put it any better, so I'm not going to try. But I think I'd ask a final question, and that is, what are your abiding memories? We've been quite negative for
and
obvious reasons.
And I have
reasons.
A final thought as well.
Okay, well, give me that one. I mean, abiding memories, we really have covered everything. You mentioned ISIL Daesh and some of the horrors that we've covered along the way as well. The changing complexion and nature of those geopolitical realities. We've talked about state actors and proxy wars and interests versus politics and involvement. I mean, goodness me, we've covered everything. Mm. What are your abiding memories?
I've always said when I've talked about the MENA region, you know, I'm presenter's friend on satellite news channels. When I sit next to the newscaster or anchor and they turn to me and they say, Dr. Hagopian, what would you think of this? Or why do you think this happened or that happened? Sometimes I'm not there and I see so-called experts who've hardly had one cup of Arabic coffee, and they suddenly become experts and they start waxing lyrical about how well they know. These are what I call the people who've got a PhD in falafel making. And they suddenly talk, and I sort of wonder, blimey, you haven't yet changed your shorts and you're already talking like an expert. And what MEA gave us, and that reflects also on your character and on your temperament and on the way we have molded MEA, and the fact that we've had other guests, but two guests, Bishop Declan and now Bishop Jim, who allow you the space to speak, who are not know-it-alls, who write, interrupt like me all the time with the insertions. And what I've enjoyed is we have used those MEAs, and that is what, when I said I missed it, I don't miss coming and sitting here. You and I can have a nice cup of coffee somewhere else. But it's the ambiance, the ability to distill some knowledge that I've had. I mean, I've lived for years and years in the Middle East, North Africa. I know the Gulf very well. I've worked as a political negotiator in the region. I've worked like a lawyer in the region. Whenever there've been alternative dispute resolution issues, I have been there for it. So I'm not somebody who just goes for 5 days, comes back and says, you know what, I have got it all now. And we have had that ability, and you've been very good at this, because you ask the question and then you listen. And we have hopefully, we've managed to reach out to some people. Who was it who said something like, I can't remember the context of the quote, but something along the lines of, if I've reached one person only, that's already one person more than I started with. Yeah. Mm. And so This is what I'm trying to say. I'm not telling anybody that you and I have written the book on this. I'm not saying that I know it all. I don't. But I don't miserably, I don't. But I also know perhaps a little more than most other people by virtue of circumstance. I've been, call it fortunate enough. There are other areas. People come and tell me, Harry, we want to do an interview on Ukraine. I say, I'm not speaking about Ukraine because I don't understand Ukraine. They say, we want you to talk about Greenland. Okay, I'm European, but I don't want to talk about the Greenland. It's not my area. Whereas the MENA and Gulf region, I've touched the soil. I have eaten the falafel in that place. I have spoken with the people, Muslim and Christian, and sometimes Jews in Israel. And I know how the mind works. So what we've done, and that is what I've really enjoyed, the ability to communicate with our listeners, whether they're 5 or 5,000. And I know you told me, and I'm very proud of that, that our last episode has gone viral. Bishop Jim, it's the number 2 highest number of people who've listened to a pod.
Yeah, wow. In our family of podcasts, yeah.
And so, in a sense, that is what I've done. And then, if I may allow myself, without being cheesy, because I'm not cheesy. If you ask my friends, they will say, Harry is too rational. You know this. At school, they used to call me Mr. Spock because it's head over heart. And head over heart tells me that our MEA episodes till February 11th, 2026 has actually helped us have a very easy friendship, you and I. And that's a friendship I'm proud of because it's an undemanding friendship. We don't see each other often. We don't even talk to each other often. But there is an understanding there that you can talk and you know that what you talk is not going to leak like a sieve.
Well, you know, it's also a matter of respect, isn't it? To have a good podcast, you need to have a good relationship, actually. And we've done, I don't even want to work out the hours, but our relationship has been with the mic up. Most of the time, as you say, we've had plenty of coffees, plenty of chats, plenty of, you know, the odd meal or two, including with Bishop Jim. But it's been a relationship on air, hasn't it?
And I can give you loads and loads of examples. I won't. But let me take just 2 examples, since we're basically circulating around religious figures. I was very, very friendly with Bishop Declan. I had a huge amount of respect for him. Not only that, but I spoke with him like you would to a man, to an equal. I didn't do all this. Oh, I can't say this. I can't say that. Ditto with Bishop Jim. And I know sometimes it amuses him no end, the things I come up with. And I wouldn't do it if it's not him. Because I have to wear my white gloves before I talk. And in that sense, it is that which I seek. And MEA has given me that proximity. One of the great philosophers said in the Greek times, proximity is the essence of infinity. So think of it. Maybe our listeners will think of it. And then when we get back, if we get back in another format, we can explain to them what that philosopher meant. You can ask me because you've got an elephant's memory.
Bishop Jim, I think we're coming close to the conclusion here. But I don't know about you. I mean, some very kind words from Harry. I don't feel worthy of that, certainly. But I think I'm still in the falafel maker camp at the moment. I've learned a lot, but I'm still a falafel maker.
I certainly know what falafel is, but I would bow before the experience of, as Harry said, he's tasted the bread. He's baked the bread. He's lived the life. He knows the region.
You know, I used to go there, Bishop, when I used to live in Jerusalem, or I was in Lebanon or in Jordan, or in elsewhere. You talked about Morocco, you talked about Iran. I've learned sometimes the easy way, sometimes the hard way. In Jerusalem, I had the Emeritus Patriarch Michel Sabah as my friend. Yes. He was also my mentor. I had a couple of Armenian priests. I had a couple of Lutheran and Anglican priests who were my friends. Here, I've got you. I've got others as well. It's how much time you take because, you know, everybody says this. I don't know how they say it. You could put it the correct way. They say people go somewhere, they spend a week there or 10 days, they come back thinking they know everything.
Yes.
Then they go back again, they spend a year there, and they realize that they've just begun to scratch the surface.
Yes, yes.
Exactly yes. right.
And if I may say, you've been comparing yourselves to the Muppets and the two gentlemen in the opera house. I don't suppose that makes me Kermit or Fozzie Bear. Certainly not Miss Piggy. But I hear that after a break of some years,
they're coming back.
They're coming back. So hope springs eternal.
I mean, is that the template? Are we sort of going to leave a little crumb of possibility here with regard to the podcast?
We could be the ecumenical Muppets of the future.
I bet we've been called ecumenical Muppets before.
Yes, I mean,
in a
probably,
slightly disparaging way.
Exactly. Somebody would have said, oh, look what this Muppet is saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, can I say on behalf of all those listeners that you don't see and who listen and have valued and will continue to value your insights, to thank you both for what you've done, the way you do it, the way you speak, and the way you speak to us, because you draw us into the conversation. And it's one of those conversations where you always leave feeling you do know a little more and a little more humble, I think, about what you don't know, but are better off for listening to the conversation. So, gentlemen, thank you both on behalf of all your fans and listeners.
Very kind.
Thank you very much, Bishop. That's very kind of you. I want to finish on a final thought. I haven't forgotten that, by the way.
Uh-huh. Do you know, we haven't offered you that in recent times, so much.
No, you haven't.
So, for old time's sake,
I feel very cheated of my final thought.
Well, you know what? You're going to be the final voice we hear, so take it away.
Having said everything that we said, and having said that we're basically going out on a cliffhanger, because we don't know whether we're coming back or not, we don't know whether we've got the energy or not, I would also add that it's not only a question of a hiatus to think and cogitate and come up with a different format, but it's also because 17 years is a long time and we've both grown up. You talked about your white beard. I also have health issues, so it would be, I think, helpful to me too to sort of take a slight distance, rest a bit. I mean, it's not the most difficult thing that I do, but still, and maybe if we have the vim and vigor, we can come back and do something else. And my thought of the day on this very subject is that I would like to reach out to all the listeners, no matter how few or how many, and to remind them that today is the World Day of the Sick. Mm-hmm. And it's a day that was proclaimed by my hero Pope, Saint Pope John Paul II, in 1992.
Who conferred a papal knighthood on you, did he not?
Yes, he did. Thank you for saying it. I thought it would be too wrong of me to put that in as well. You looked at me with your raised eyebrows and you said it. So I would like to think of all the people who suffer, all the people who've got ailments, psychological, physical, mental, and say that you're not alone. I know that because I live on my own, but I'm not alone, nor are they. Goodbye to them, and maybe, as the bishop said at the very start of this final episode of Middle East Analysis, it's an au revoir, it's not an adieu.